The following audio was recorded at the Pacific School Leadership Institute, which was held October 24 and 25, 2019, in Spokane, Washington.
I've really enjoyed meeting some of you and am really enjoying our time. And again, it's a privilege, a real privilege for us to be here with you. School matters, past, present, and future. And I'd like to take a very brief, this deserves an hour-long session probably, but I'm going to take a very brief, about three-minute journey back several years to help us understand the Anabaptist Christian school movement in the beginning. Now, some of our schools started very recently. Some of them started a very long time ago. And many schools started in the 70s. As our people saw the devastation of the 60s, the loose and promiscuous lifestyle, the unhooking of morality from the way that things really are and the way the real world works, and the unhooking of morality from Scripture, and the shift in the social center from church and family to the public school, or as most saw it, the world, we started schools. And it was appropriate to move from secular and public education to private and Christian schools. The founders of our schools in that era saw the wreckage begin to infiltrate our churches due to public education and were intent on it not being part of their story. And so with great effort, sacrifice, mention was made this morning of State versus Yoder. Great effort and sacrifice. They pulled out of the comfortable, the normal, the easy, and the free in order to offer something better for the sake of their children. If we are honest, though, we will probably admit that at least some of the energy for the Christian school movement was a reaction to what was. We wanted out of the public schools, and we wanted it to happen very quickly. We didn't have curriculum, we didn't have trained staff, we didn't have adequate funding, and we didn't have prior experience to begin our Christian schools. We had none of those things. What did we have? We had practical wherewithal. We had heart for this, and we did have a vision. And the vision and foresight of those in the 60s and 70s has indisputably been a great gift and blessing. I think even saving us from an almost sure apostatizing at the worst and losing our identity as close followers of Jesus and Anabaptists at best. But as history shows repeatedly, movements grow up. They mature. And the Christian school movement is along the path fairly well. There's rod and staff. There's Christian light. There are things that are in place that have that tell us that, yes, we're growing up. Now, different people offer different terms for organizational life cycles. And you're familiar with this. And in terms of the beginning stages, you know, courtship, infant, the go-go stage, adolescence, prime, late prime, and then, of course, there's all kinds of approaches that people take to this. Or this one, the birth, the growth, maturity, decline, and then two options, revival or death. So where are we today? I want you to think about that as a school board member or as a school leader. Where is your school in this cycle? I suggest that we can't be in reaction mode, focusing on getting our children out of the public school and keeping them out. That's what birthed us, and I applaud that vision. But we are, many of our schools are past the growth stage and are in the maturity or, in some cases, may I say, the decline stage? And when we reach the decline part of the life cycle, It's imperative that we renew to bring us back to the growth stage. Now, growth does not mean more numbers. That's not what I'm talking about. Growth is far more than how many students in school. Growth is about utilizing the best curriculum that's available to us. It's about teachers developing, about board members leading, and about having a heart for the rising generation. So this morning, I propose that we recognize that many of our schools are past that growth stage. We've grown up a little bit, and we're kind of leaning in to the decline in at least some of our schools. This does not call for reaction and a response riddled with fear. Rather, it should call us to action. And that action maybe could be that our schools not only be a refuge from the world as we started, but more importantly, a resource for the world. Rather than basing our existence on reaction to what's out there, suppose we re-envisioned what we want to offer our world. Suppose that would drive and motivate our schools. So I would like to look at three areas this morning: vision, practice, and people. Vision, practice, and people. School boards have been entrusted with the task of leading our schools. One of the foremost roles in a board member's job description is to cast a vision. So there's questions that board members ought to consider asking themselves. What do we want? Can you describe in one sentence what you hope for in your school? Howard Hendricks tells the story of going to preach in a church. He met the pastor and the service began, and he got up to the pulpit and he was taken aback because taped right in the middle of the pulpit in bold letters was a message: "What in the world are you doing here?" And it rattled him. The whole session did not go very well for him. And he was off his speaking game, as it were, the whole time. He just, what's that sign? What's that mean? So afterwards, he asked the pastor, what was the sign about? And the pastor of the church said, oh, that. Well, one day I got up to preach and he said, it struck me. Here are a whole group of people who are sitting here and they're expecting something from me. And he said, I realized I did not have a clear picture of what I wanted to accomplish. I decided, he said, that I would never get in front of an audience again without knowing what my purpose for speaking was. So I made a sign to remind me about why I'm doing what I'm doing. What in the world are you doing in your school? Do we know where we're going? What do we care about? What kind of students do we want to produce? And the decisions that you make at board level will deeply affect the lives of the individual student. Sometimes we detach these decisions about policy and direction as if it doesn't affect individual students, and it does. It matters. Your work as a board member matters. Board members ought to be on the board because they have a heart. Our churches sometimes, I think, have a bit of a, may I suggest, mistaken notion about who should be on the board. It's sometimes like going through the membership list and, wow, Brother Johnny, he's not been on the board for a long time. It's time he serves again. Without thinking about, does Brother Johnny, and I don't mean our brother that spoke this morning, does Brother Johnny, I can tell he cares, does Brother Johnny, does he know what it takes to be on a board? Is he committed to working hard on the school board? Will he bring things for the school that we need? This isn't just about taking turns always. There are really, really, really good men that don't always make the greatest board members. Can I say that? It's a gifting thing. Now, I'm all for lots of involvement. I think you would know that. But I'm suggesting to you, this work of the board is very important. I heard one person say to me once, well, by putting him on the board, maybe he'll understand how important the school is. I hope. But no guarantees. See, I kind of think that our schools are one of the last threshing machines in our communities. As we do fewer and fewer barn raising, and maybe in the West here you do a lot of those, where you really all help each other build houses and build the little pole barn and the shed, and you help each other reshingle. And I'm supposing more of that happens in the West than the East, but I would say it's declining a fair amount among our people. That used to bring us together. It was something we did together. And it was part of the woven fabric of church life, something we all put our shoulder to, we all sacrificed for. We spent time and money and energy helping each other. What is our threshing machine today? And I propose that one of the last threshing machines, functionally, practically, is the Christian school. That in itself is a good enough reason to have a Christian school. This is the one place in which we come together and bring our resources, our time, our money, and energy into one place. How is your threshing machine crew doing? What's your vision? Brothers on school boards, your primary work on the school board is to provide leadership for the school. And as leadership goes, so goes the school. Secondly, practice. It's been demonstrated from several vantage points. You could talk about the practical, just looking around, being observant, and there's all kinds of things we could talk about here. But it's been demonstrated that the habits and practices of an individual create a certain kind of person and will write a story over time. Our habits and practices inform belief. More than that, our habits and practices form belief. In other words, what we do in large measure determines who we become. Now, before you write this off, think about it carefully. And I'm going to let this one stew for you. I'm not going to, this deserves another hour, but we don't have that space. The things that we do shape who we are. And I know, growing up, I reacted to, well, just do what we're saying, and then eventually you'll understand. Well, the truth is, there's truth there. The fact is that the reason the sports world has had such an incredible impression on America, on Mennonites, on young people, is because there are certain habits and practices that take place in ball games. It's a worship service from the vantage point of the American ideal. And those things, the way they sing the Star Spangled Banner at the beginning, the way the referee begins the game, the very first opening tip-off, or whatever it is, the way there's cheerleaders, the way people will get up and yell and scream and put their entire heart into it, those shape their love for the game. Habits and practices shape who we are. It's true for an individual and it's true for an organization, a school. The habits and practices of the school forms the beliefs and values of the school. In other words, what your school does will determine partly what your school becomes, who it becomes. So what practices do your school have in place? What stories get told? Take an evaluation in the present. What stories get told? What songs do you sing? Do you sing? How much do you sing? If you're a school that sings a lot, it will shape your school a certain direction. Do you have regular monthly board meetings, even when you don't feel like it? Those practices will shape the school. Do your board meetings go after 9:30? If so, I have two words for you. Stop it. It's not worth it. I know, I've been to board meetings at 12:30 at night. I get this, but little good happens after 9:30. Those practices will change the way your school actually functions, the way your board meetings go. If you know you only have 2.5 hours to get all the business taken care of, you will tend to keep things moving along. You might rearrange your agenda. You might have more stuff ahead of time to everybody so they can be thinking about what's going on. You might even, perish the thought, have an agenda out 3 days before the meeting. Now, that's a novel idea. And I know how busy we are, but you see, those practices shape us. And so it becomes actually important. That agenda out communicates the chairman is on this. He knows what we want to talk about. And here's the four paragraphs that you asked the principal to write describing one of the problems we have to solve tonight. It shapes your school. That's a simple practice. Do you have the habit of talking about your vision for the school regularly? Do parents show up for school events? What are the traditions that nurture a healthy school culture? And of course, the practices and habits, the way that relationships are done, will greatly impact the story your grandchildren will tell of your work as a school board member. John D. Roth says this in his book. He might not say that after all. We'll leave that. Okay, that slide is missing. He says this: if there's anything in the Anabaptist Mennonite identity worth preserving, then this tradition will need to be consciously cultivated, debated, modeled, and taught. This can happen at home, in worship, in Sunday school, in church camps, many other settings, but the most likely context for the transmission of a living tradition, living habits and practices, will be in our schools. Unquote. People. I just want to tell you that people, this thing's having a few issues. Here we go. We got it now. It's about the people, folks. It's about the people. As a teacher and principal, I've been in the classroom long enough to endure the stories of school life in days gone by from former students. You know, when they come back and tell you, did you know that one day I, and then you fill in the blanks and your heart kind of sinks, and how did I not see that? And really, what was that about? You know, was I that terrible? And anyway, so I've kind of been through that, I guess. More than once, I have winced at the stories told about a classroom discussion that a former student remembered, or an unkind remark from another student that turned the child against the school or the church. I've also heard the stories of board members who have deeply invested into school life, and they're remembered for that. I've heard the stories of the teachers that made a difference. I've heard the stories of the parents who regularly volunteered, and students remember that mom with great fondness. So I'd like to tell you several stories. Keeping in mind that, folks, it's about the people. And I, in order to tell stories here, I don't like being that far away from you, okay? So I'm going to come up here if that's okay. Now, for my elementary education, we went to a rural public school. And when I was in first and second grade, I had a teacher, a godly teacher who cared about her students learning to read and build a good foundation of character. And she wasn't a Mennonite, but she was a very godly lady. And it might be hard for you to believe, but I had a tendency to talk too much. That's repentance there. Mrs. Morris wanted to build character in her students, and one day she needed to go out of class in order to make some copies. And as a class, we struggled in the department of being quiet when she left the room briefly. Okay, we just kind of had trouble doing that. And one day she left with the room with clear instructions, do not talk, but work on your seat work. Unbeknownst to us, on her way out, she hit a play button on a tape recorder. That's something that some of you don't know anything about. The tape recorders used to be a thing. And she put the record button on that tape recorder and went out to make her copies. And of course, we were talking and doing things we weren't supposed to do. So she returned, came back. Of course, we were all angelic because you could see her shadow through the window right before she got there. And so we were suddenly angelic. And without a word, she walked over to the tape recorder, hit stop, hit rewind, and hit play. And what should come out of that recorder but the voice of yours truly? I blanched, I blushed. I was thinking when she went over to the tape recorder, we were going to have a little music or do something fun instead. I was fidgeting. And as a class, we listened to 3 minutes of general chaos. Then she said, "Students, I'm disappointed. I thought you could do better than this." And then she went on. Over 35 years later, I still remember the shame of that moment. Shame I deserved. I remember her compassion for a little boy who couldn't keep his mouth shut. And I remember how it changed me, how it actually impacted me in first grade. Today, I greatly respect Mrs. Morris. And then when I was in fifth and sixth grade, I had a teacher. She was fresh out of college. Her name was Miss Croker, spelled differently than what it sounds. But Miss Croker was a wonderful person. She loved her students. And when I got into 5 and 6, the problem was I didn't like school anymore. Because in grade 3 and 4, I had a teacher, her name was Mrs. Wilt. Mrs. Wilt was about 90 years old, 45 years ago, she died recently. You know what I'm talking about? She was one who used threats to manage her classroom. So she would say things like, "Now, if you don't write your name on your paper, I'm going to prick your finger and write your name in blood." Now, she would have never done that. She went to a evangelical church in a little town of Abbeville, not so far away. So I think she actually probably was a believer. But that was the way she did things. She would say things like, "I'm gonna give you 39 lashes with a wet noodle." And when you're a third grader, you don't know what a wet noodle is actually like that you get 39 lashes with, but you know you don't want it. That's all you know. She ruled with an iron hand. She really did. On the way out of the class, if you got out of, you know, when you're lining up for recess and you got all in a straight row and you were out of line, on the way out, she would take her fingernails. And they were long. They were healthy. And she would take her fingers, and on a third grade boy, or a fourth grade boy, she would dig her fingers in, and you would end up walking out of the classroom like this, under her iron hand. She kept control, but I hated school. Miss Croker thought that every student should be able to learn. She made it her business to teach thoroughly and teach well. But classroom management did not go well for her. She was so nice, and it just didn't go. Now, the backstory is that she actually inspired me to begin to enjoy school. And I began to see, I do love school. I had loved school. Now I'm loving it again. And I worked really hard. I really liked her. She was so kind to me. And of course, I deserve much of what I got in Mrs. Wilt's room. But this was something so different. I became very attached to her. And I did everything I could to please her. Of course, what that meant is now I was the teacher's pet. And so that was what I was called, a teacher's pet. And I didn't know what to do with that, except I just tried harder, which made me more of a teacher's pet. Because it went from being not a very good boy. My mother talks about the record number of spankings in one church service being 5 for me. So I was not a very nice, I don't know. God bless her. She's an amazing woman. And she WhatsApped me this morning and said, I'm praying for you today. That's amazing. But my mother cared enough, and my father, to really work me over. But it was difficult to be in fifth and sixth grade and to be the teacher's pet. And I remember very well walking back into the classroom after lunch, and in those days, not everyone was right there. The teachers weren't necessarily right there when you got back from recess. And two boys, their names were John and Arthur, they came over to me. I can still take you to that spot in that classroom, which they came over to me. They were the bullies of the class. And they, in front of the rest of the students, they took my shirt off of me in the presence of all students. If you're a fifth grade boy in front of all the girls and your shirt is yanked off of you, of course they're laughing, and you know what I'm talking about. I remember the hot tears of embarrassment as I struggled to get my shirt back on, and I ran out into the hallway. And I remember Miss Croker understanding what was going on. She understood the shame and she cared. I was the boy with the severe stuttering problem. I was the boy who was the teacher's pet. And she reached out to me and affirmed me. Over 30 years later, I still remember Miss Croker. When I was in high school, I remember my principal making the case for a change that was very necessary, actually, but it was not a popular change. And the principal stood there, and I remember students being incredibly disrespectful. And I remember him standing in front of the school, handling vicious criticism that should never have been a part of the school, and taking it, tears in his eyes, and unswerving in his conviction. 25 years later, that memory's with me. I remember a board member coming to me as a new teacher. I taught one whole year. I was barely out of Pampers. I guess we didn't have those back then, seemed like. And he saw something in me that I didn't know I had. And he asked if I would help start the church school. And I remember how little I really knew, and I didn't even know at the time how little I did know. And I remember the confidence and walking alongside the board provided me as we started a new school with a new building, and we worked hard at starting something from the ground up. The board knew my weaknesses, plural. But they believed in me and helped gave me the tools and support that I needed. The kind of foresight they had is really astonishing. They created a board handbook, a staff handbook, and a student handbook to create a stable school that is seen by today's standards, virtually no teacher turnover. In 20 years from now, we will hear the stories of your school, of your board, the decisions and the methods, the conversations and the finances and all the things that go into making the school run will be a story that will be told. And the stories that will be told, though, will be primarily about the people. The students, the teachers, board members, pastors, parents, the community. As boards, I beg you to invest in people, primarily in your teachers and principals. These are people who will have influence and about whom the stories will be told. And I know we have trouble hiring people, right? In fact, hiring warm bodies can be challenging. But it's too important to hire warm bodies. Who do you want your children to be like? That's who you want to hire. Don't brush off the power and effect of 6 hours every day for 35 weeks every year. It will tell a story. In our schools, people are the greatest commodity. As you spend time here at the Pacific School Leadership Institute, hopefully some of these sessions you'll hear today will help us, right? And help us improve the future story of our schools. What are the three things that you will do going forward to improve your school? What will you do with what you have learned? What will be your story? Psalm 78 has not been read here yet, and I'd like to read it. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn, rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God. Where are we at? Past, present, future. Where do you want to go? How much do you value your Christian school? How much do you value a Christian education? How much do you sacrifice for the Christian school? Is it worth it? What would make it worth it? Is a school a living part of your church? See, the church needs to see education as a way to prepare young people for the truly good life, not the American dream. We can no longer be only a safe haven for the rising generation. It needs to be safe. We will lose our young people if we go solely into protection mode. We need to see ourselves as resources for a broken world. We are developing soldiers in a cosmic battle in which God is winning. He does depend, though, on his church to carry the kingdom vision forward. I have a vision that our people be a force for the darkness of this world to reckon with, a battle against the spirit of the age, a vision where godly, thoughtful lovers and worshipers of God, where people selflessly love each other, and so by our love will be known to be followers of Jesus. Lovers of God, not of this world. Lovers of God, not America. Lovers of God, not lovers of money. And I close with this story. Annette Simmons tells this story. A man came upon a construction site where three people were working. And he went to the first, and he said, "What are you doing?" And the man replied, "I'm laying bricks." He asked the second, "What are you doing?" The man replied, "I'm building a wall." And he approached the third and heard him humming a tune as he worked. And he asked him, "What are you doing?" The man stood, he looked up at the sky, and he smiled, and he said, "I'm building a cathedral." What are you building? What is your vision? What will your story be?